Okay, well, welcome to this theme session on next generation providers. And we're very fortunate, I think, to have Chris Yap. I mean, the theme leaders in this conference have been are absolutely key, and they really have the hardest job to try and distill from the papers and the symposia and the workshops the views and issues emerging across the conference, and then to shape these into some issues to present back and to discuss. So, and I can't imagine anyone better to do this on this topic than Chris Yap. So I think the idea is that Chris will present his summary of the issues. If everything has worked, then the chairs from the various sessions will have communicated with Chris, and Chris will have distilled into some issues. So Chris is going to talk for 20 minutes or so, but I think if there are issues that emerge during the session, please just indicate, and we'll try and have a discussion. Because the session is being recorded, if you want to speak or make a contribution, just indicate, and I'll come across with the hand mic. Okay, so Chris, over to you. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much. Right, I've got 10 slides which sort of like summarise the thing, and I sort of want to rattle through them, but please, as I said, if there are the specific places where you may want to interrupt as we're going through the process, but let's start on it. I just want to make an observation. I mean, this is a much bigger conference than when I spoke at it a few years ago, and I think there's some observations now that you are large enough and have a heritage and a growth, which is to actually ask, who is ALT for? What is its purpose? And what are its attitudes to the L and the T? I mean, is it an association for little learning and big technology, for big learning and little technology, or blended? You see, I think it's very interesting that this is the kind of conference where I come, where people are talking about individual point technologies like wikis and repositories. I go to other places and they talk about platforms. So the interesting thing would be to have a debate about what a constructivist learning platform might look like as opposed to somebody else's type of platform, rather than what can you do with a wiki or how does podcasting, you know. And it is this very much that it's an individual technology. So it's almost like this is a conference for the sort of people who want to know how to do crankshafts on Morris Minors, rather than people who want to know what you can do with a car. And so I think that just want to reflect onto that in terms of the way in which you engage. And with the size and scale of this community now, could be very influential. So the question is it that what you want to do is to enhance the experience of learning for adults across the whole of the UK, for instance, if that's the kind using technology? And that's, I think, a fundamental challenge I think that you need to face. So I want to make that observation, because the comments I'm going to make back to you and from the chairs and the conversations in between some of the sessions, I think depend upon that mission, as to how you take those back. The question I think that we've occasionally got into it, and in that last session we had some very interesting sort of things down in SR112. The question about the next generation providers is, are they today's providers? Are they a consolidation or partnership of existing partners? Is it about the globalization of certain big brands, the sort of things that Tim O'Shea was talking yesterday about it? Or is the sector going to be determined by new entrants, be it new private-for-profit, private universities, or indeed the private sector creaming off certain areas? Or are we going to see something on radical transformation in terms of the provision? I was discussing with a number of people what the idea of an Amazon university might look like. People who like this lecture also like this one. People who study this module like this module, and actually build it where the entire infrastructure is a support infrastructure and you have very, very flexible academic contracts. There's enabled people to do it, and this seems to be quite an interesting thing, listening to what people are saying about what academics wanted in this kind of environment. So the extent to which technology might allow for a radical transformation and actually enable superstar lecturers to actually develop their own brands that were far bigger than the institutions in which they are. We all know that there are some in that. So there is an interesting issue, an underlying one, in a number of the presentations that have come out on that, which I think needs to have a debate, but again, it needs to have it within the context of what is the purpose of ALT. Some observations that have come up about discussions on the rising generation and the digital natives, the digital digerati, the fact that these kids are coming up. But of course, with the pensions crisis, what about the over 50s? A lot of the institutions now have a lot of part-time students, people doing qualifications in their 40s, 50s. That's going to go up over the years. What is the issue in regard to, you know, we're making assumptions about the learned body that isn't actually, you know, we've got to be very careful on this sort of thing. So if we're going to have lots of institutions with lots of people in their 40s, 50s and 60s, they ain't going to be the iPod generation by and large. And therefore, the interesting issues about the role and how we support inducting that is going to be interesting in there. The issues on choice and personalisation, which is very, very hot in the schools debates at the moment. I was on one of the DFES working groups on personalisation, and the extent to which empowering the learner and some of the models like Ultraversity, where undergraduate research-based models, these sorts of things are important. There are all sorts of issues on international dimensions. I mean, we had in the last session a discussion on nursing qualifications, for instance, because more nurses, you know, will work between different countries. So you actually need a brand, an awarding body, which has international recognition and international study if somebody's to be able to move from the Philippines to the UK to and these sort of things. So there are international dimensions around the learner that we need to think about. So just saying, well, we have a great brand and we're a credible awarding body, you know, actually, you've got to be a bit cautious on this. A lot of discussions have come up about the way in which the new generation, I'm saying about the older learners, about the younger ones now, is about actually who provides the technology. You know, are the youngsters going to come in and bring, and what the university will do is specify minimum standards of the technology they require, and the university will make no provision other than those for widening access and social equity issues. And then they will provide the infrastructure, but the personal devices will be the responsibility of the learner. That's a debate because it has an ethical issue, of course, in terms of widening participation. It has issues around accessibility, for instance, around here. But I think that, you know, if I had stood up here and talked about universities as if they were all 18 to 21-year-olds, I'd get booed. I did once, because I did it deliberately. But actually, a lot of the assumptions have been that it's all about the younger generation, and actually, I think it's not. So I think that needs to be there. Been quite a few references to the neuroticism of academics about the extent to which technology begins to control them, the way in which leaders are using these things and putting more bureaucracy and using... So technology equals bureaucracy is a debate that's been going through in a number of issues on here. Concerns over the use of technology around the management of their reputation, accreditation. I will share my materials if it is accredited. And so I'm going to come back to this issue. There's been a lack of clarity in a lot of the debates around the whole issue of intellectual property. Who owns it? Is it the university? Is it the individual? Is it the... And all of these sorts of issues have come around. And there have been some interesting debates, actually, when you listen between the sessions. I mean, there's been one... I give one example, was... what I want to be able to do is to take the tags off this object because they're not relevant to me and put my tags on and do it. Academics believe in sharing, and then you get the other side, is I don't want people to be able to take the tags off because I want to be accredited for my contribution. So the question about how you encapsulate or embed or preserve those things, it becomes quite an interesting issue. There's been a lot of stuff around the academic and the whole thing around continuous professional development, expectations of the skill sets. You know, people saying... We have academics who can't construct web pages. I mean, that's an interesting... Should they be expected to? I mean, it's a good question if you're a philosophy tutor. Should you see it as part of your CV? Is it part of the contract between you and the institution that's something you should do? And so I think there's a set of issues around that. On the benchmarking, some observations, having been involved in benchmarking for 20-odd years, can we get to where we need by intersector benchmarking? I'll give you... two things. I'm doing some benchmarking with local authorities and Microsoft because local authorities currently orders and invoices cost between £90 and £110. In Microsoft it runs at $3 and $5. Saying that, you know, we're in the top quartile of local authorities is actually pretty meaningless when they're all grossly inefficient. I don't know what the order and invoicing charges would be within a university, but they're probably not down at the $3 and $5. So if you're spending that amount of money in admin and you want to free new money for teaching and learning, that's where it comes from. How many methodologies do you need? You know, would it be better to invest behind one or two, or do you need 20? You know, do you need a pick and mix of pick and mixes and whatever? And I think in there, there's the whole issue of whether benchmarking is around, it's the process that matters more than the output and the outcome, the product, that actually the way in which you conduct it, and a lot of the benefits come from that. All sorts of issues around stakeholder engagement, a recognition, I think, that so far there's been an underplay in involvement of students and the learners in this process. It's been very much a supply-side-driven issue around there. The role of employers as stakeholders in these things. And, of course, stakeholder management comes down to the international dimension, again, has come up in a number of things. And, again, I think there's a strong commitment from what I've seen to using benchmarking, as long as it's about identifying what to change and how to change, and it's not about league tables. And therefore, there's a real sort of interesting set of challenges in there, given the sort of nature of the funding and what the funders might want in this kind of environment. Jonathan Darby did a very interesting discussion on the whole issue of support, and I think that this is, again, very, very important, sort of contrasting as a, if like a professional outsider, is about inducting people into a new institution, about what is it, what are their expected behaviours, how are the skills you need to be able to operate within this university. You know, plonking somebody down in one department, and it gets to be quite interesting. I mean, how you would, you know, these are things that a new entrant, for instance, would look at very, very clearly in terms of how you would do these things. I mentioned this issue of expectation. We have academics that can't write web pages. I mean, what is a legitimate expectation of it? And what are the expectations in the other way around in terms of how we support them and what we do? Expectations on intellectual property, all sorts of issues on expectations around the support. Again, looking at the sort of discussions, we had a discussion yesterday evening with a number of people who'd been on the whole issue of in-house support versus shared services type models and outsourced models on support. You know, if the delivery side of higher education in particular doesn't have a high regard for IT support within the institutions, does that mean it would rather outsource it or move it to some shared service model? What does that do culturally in terms of it? That's, I think, a set of fruitful conversations. Big daddy of them all, I suspect, is around all sorts of issues on governance have cropped up. We are a research university. We are highly devolved. We have autonomous things. The question is that stable? Is that viable across the transition? Can you go from pilot e-learning to full embedded e- and blended models down with that kind of thing successfully? I mean, so, you know, people are making assumptions that the new providers are the old providers, and that's the way it will work. That may not be the case, and it's worth thinking about the nature of leadership in the transition to the e-world. Again, all the issues around governance have cropped up on the issues on stakeholder management in here, about how you listen to students, how you engage with them, as you know, with top-up fees and all those other sort of things in here. And again, the international dimension comes up. The issue on governance on things like portfolios is, does the portfolio belong to the individual, the institution, or even to the course, has come up in a number of places. And again, you know, one of the interesting things, coming from the private sector, if I was advising somebody on how they would move into this sector, I would think about making sure that portfolio belonged to the individual and actually develop it as a shared service. Again, that has interesting things about the reputation. If you believe that your reputation comes on the credibility of your awards, if that portfolio element is taken away from you. The governance of IPR has come up, and particularly around digital rights management. And things like the Creative Commons. I know that I've been very heavily involved in the Creative Commons over the last 18 months. We've just done some things in Microsoft and making the Creative Commons tagging for all of the Office product set. Issues on the governance for assessment and accreditation, particularly on things like European-funded projects, international, multi-institutional ones, actually recognising credit transfers, recognising different sort of qualifications, all these sorts of issues. The governance of partnerships. I might say my experience, by the way, is that my experience of British higher education is it often you get institutions will partner better with other institutions than they will internally within their own, with other departments in their own university. That's something we have in common with the private sector, by the way. It's not a snipe. The extent on curriculum and the governance of it. The sense in which I think a lot of the discussion is that HE has much more freedom on curriculum than FE. So if you have a partnership between FE and HE, then the interesting thing is what the sort of models would come out in terms of how you would build those sorts of the things. So if we ended up in sort of the sort of model that might be implied by Tim O'Shea of global research-led universities with big brand which are residential and then as hubs and then spokes are these other ones who are teaching universities associated with that, you know, that you end up with how many universities do research in chemistry and how many teach it. And those may be different sort of models I think it's worth thinking about. But the whole governance issue has interesting ramifications. There's been two discussions going on about libraries are dead, students don't use them, versus the argument that actually libraries are the future. Or is actually the curators and the skills are actually the future. There are some interesting things in this sort of area. It's been nice to see discussions around the role of technology within the use of physical space and the flexibility that come from it. So all the issues about what is the actual value of the campus itself and the study bedroom and all the facilities that you have. And, of course, the big asset is the issue on reputation and credibility of awards. And, again, with globalisation, the question is how many institutions in the UK actually are credible at the global level? And that is, and then, therefore, how do you build and sustain in these sort of models? Because these are, the important elements. I think every single presentation has had that slippery word, culture. And culture is always a barrier. It's never an enabler. You know, you'd never get that. It's interesting, that, isn't it? The culture of leadership within higher education, the sense of autonomy. The fact is that no institution has a single culture, but actually has diverse cultures. And this seems to be a surprise to some of the people here. It's quite interesting. All the issues around behaviours within the thing, what is unacceptable and things. It's quite interesting, then, if you look at the issue of behaviours and ethics, about people saying issues like, well, I wouldn't expect somebody to come in and watch my lecture without me knowing, but they go and observe me in cyberspace of what I'm doing and what I'm using, that sense of control. It's quite interesting if I contrast you with, say, medical conferences, and I'm just off to a medical conference from here, is something of this scale would have a strand on ethics. What are the ethics of e-learning? And it's been interesting, and again, coming back down to fundamental purpose on this. The international dimension, things like languages and pedagogy in different cultures, you know, working with China or with France or the Netherlands, we have different traditions of how we teach and how we help people learn. And then trying to create object repositories for learning to support different types of cultural assumptions about how learning works. Huge, huge sets of issues that have come up, and very interesting talk in the last session, on the how do you move from pilots to embedding. Lots and lots of, you know, it's the famous quote of more pilots in education than British Airways, sort of arguments on this. And the question is, and I remember Paul Baxish's one, let a thousand flowers wilt. You know, this is the sort of, there. And the whole issue that actually this is about managing change, and that's about setting expectations and managing it. So I think there's a lot around the cultural issues. That, as I said, that a new entrant would think in a lot about that from a... So that's what I wanted to do, was to say those are the sort of themes that have come up. And I think, if you like, some of the diverse issues that we've been discussing in this theme. So over to you, Terry.
Awesome. Thanks.
We have...
I can see several people in the audience who I know will have views on many of the issues that Chris has raised there. Ian, do you want to start?
Thank you, Ian Howie. I'm fiercely further educational. I'm very interested in the start of your observation about what is ALT for, because whereas it seems year on year there are very strong themes, underlying themes emerge, which may not be the themes that are explicit, but emerge in the informal discussion. In the formal part, I have to say it still feels like we're all presenting issues around playing with things. The point about, you know, blogging, this year it's blogging and podcasting and wikis and all that sort of stuff. We're still playing with things. And one of the worst phrases I heard, and I won't quote the presenter, but it was also said several other times, was VLEs, that's old technology. We played with them a few years ago. And the sad thing for me is that we haven't got to the stage where we want to just knuckle down and get mature at some of this stuff. Irrespective of what the technology is, the technology inevitably will change. But to throw something away, like a, you know, a throwaway line that VLE is old technology before we've actually cracked how we deal with learning in VLEs, I think is quite disappointing. And I just wondered what you thought, how you thought ALT should address this as far as ALT-C is concerned in getting the point that you made about the contrast between this conference and the contrast which SAID looks at learning platforms and the whole use of learning platforms irrespective of the technology of that platform. Because I think we're not on that side of the fence, we're on the side of playing with things largely at ALT-C.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is whether one of the things ALT should actually come up with is a reference framework for a learning platform. You know, I mean, just what would be the architecture of an overall approach to a learning platform based upon learning theory? That would actually be something that ALT could do. But is that something ALT wants to do? I mean, that's why I'm not saying it ought to, but I think it has now a scale and maturity that it ought to consider that is something it might consider doing. Again, going back to the issue on benchmarking externally, if I give you an example from my world, we've been building systems now for the Freedom of Information Act for a lot of public sector bodies, and of course universities are covered by the FOI. And one of the things we couldn't allow was for the individuals who created the documents to do their own tagging. Because the member of the public who comes in and asks for that document may not ask for it in the way that it's been stored or tagged by the creator. So the tagging process for all of the documents for FOI for the major government departments that run our platform, I can't comment on competitor platforms, all of the tagging is actually done behind the wall. You create the document, you file it, and it just looks like standard office, but behind it, everything gets put in so that an inquiry comes in from outside that says, I want to find that document. And as long as it's not exempted from FOI, you can find it. And a lot of the discussions came up on tagging as to, you know, was it the way you tagged it or whatever. Now, again, from a bench, that's serious, serious, important stuff. And the interesting thing would be to get somebody in from that world to say, this is how we tackle this problem so that the users don't have to do this. And it's a combination of technologies. And I think, so again, it's about who you invite to speak and the kinds of business challenges, if you like, that they're taking so that it actually comes into a proper engineering discipline about how you build those platforms. So I think that's a... But it's your organisation, not mine. So, next one. Do you
Can you just say who you are? Hi, I'm Drew from Manchester. This idea of playing with things, I think it will always be there. I think we've got this situation where, I mean, for instance, as part of the research that I presented on the other day, we talked to the head of, basically the head of IT of a very large American state university, and they've got WebCT as their campus solution. But there are also little pockets of different systems. I mean, if you happen to see my presentation, I was describing two of those pockets, one of which has grown their own system and maintains it, one of which uses Moodle. And I said to the big head of IT guy, this huge, bearded, computer geeky man, nice guy, talked a lot. I said to him, you know, as part of, does this bother you? And he said, as a manager, he has to say yes. As an administrator, he has to say yes, it bothers him. But he said, you know, the two caveats to that. One is, if they can afford it, let them do it. If they've got the money, if they're supporting it, if they're willing to resource it, fine. He says, I don't care about that. And he said the second and probably more important and useful thing for what I'm trying to say is, he said, look, we are administrators. We are not researchers. We are not innovators. We do not have the mandate to do this. We, you know, and this technology has moved from being the Lone Ranger-style innovation of some people in the University of British Columbia, in the case of WebCT, up into being this mature technology, and I say mature in the sense of that it's reached the institutional level, but yes, we don't quite know how to deal with it. We don't quite know what the impact of that is on on the business of the university or the universities as workplaces. But he said anyway, he said, I've got to let these people innovate. If the organisation is to learn and to continue to learn and to continue to absorb all these innovations that are coming in from other fields, coming in from other areas of IT or other areas of people's social lives, and they're going to bring it in, then he said, we've got to let people innovate. The trick for the next generation of providers has got to be, you know, how do you try to get a mature institutional strategic view of e-learning and at the same time not get to the stage where you settle on one solution, close off all possible alternatives, and we know how fast things move. How do you combine the playing that has to go on and the institutional needs?
It's a central and important debate, and I think the point is I showed you up there the three different ways of representing ALT. There will be technologies that are genuine at the new end, and you need to play with those and think about them. There's then a question about how do you adapt them so that you actually put a learning focus, and it's big is on the L side. And then there is the mature thing about how you then make those move together. And I do think you do have those different strands. And I, if this didn't have an element of play, it wouldn't be a viable institution. But if you want to have it to be effective and influential within the sector, you've got to have that disciplinary bit. And if you're just saying, oh, they're just a bunch of people who play with the technology, then the trouble is even if you're doing good stuff, it won't embed. And that's the test, the challenge I think you've got to try and deal with.
Hi, I'm Maggie and I'm from Leeds. I've been involved with learning technologies for a very long time. And in the mid-1990s, I was setting up a distance learning course, and I wanted to go fully online then. And somebody in the computer support department said to me, no, it can't be done, and if it could, it would cost an arm and a leg. Now, that shows how fast things have moved on. But the point I'm trying to make is that people at senior levels in institutions act as gatekeepers, yes, and they do try to keep a lid on innovation. And I think we've got a real problem with getting innovation versus control of the systems. People are very worried about security at the higher levels, but if they stop too much, then don't they kill off the innovation that they're really looking for?
Absolutely, and I think, again, the question is about who you invite to speak and how you listen to them and how you engage with that community, I think, becomes quite important. I mean, that's why I would be concerned. You know, I gave the example, how many universities should be doing chemistry research and how many should be teaching it. Now, it might be that actually the trouble is with the current structure of HE and FE in the UK, we have too many departments that are subcritical mass to have the capacity to be able to flex budgets and resource to be able to do that. The trouble is no one individual institution is going to want to lose one department, and we see what happens, say, when Exeter loses its chemistry department. So you can think of these sorts of challenges. And again, that's why I think wrestling with this governance model, wrestling with the governance model down and trying to understand that and trying to look at how you allocate the resources. But I point out, I think it was McFarlane in about the late 1990s pointed out that HE spent less on R&D on itself than any industry in the UK other than glue manufacturing. I think that's a genuine problem. And again, the point is, should each of the 150-odd institutions in HE plus all the FE institutions be doing it on their own, or is it you have five national centres of excellence, or whatever it is? And again, that's, again, how do you do that? And then those are the challenges I think you've got to face.
I think there's a bit of sort of double thinking in the way we view innovation. Yeah, I'm Jonathan Darby, Oxford Insight. I think there's some double thinking in how we view innovators and innovation, particularly with regards to students, because on the one hand, we tend to think of them as being rather a conservative force. They don't use our forums. They say they prefer to continue going to lectures and things like that. On the other hand, they are being intensely innovative in the technologies they select, the applications they find for themselves, the sources. In one bit of research, we even encountered a complete parallel VLE that had been set up and run by students with helpful information on courses, assignments, and so on that the academic staff knew nothing about. So what we often do, I think, by trying to be innovative ourselves, we actually stifle and impede the innovation of our students. And I wonder whether, you know, the future for providers is actually to pull back from many of these areas they've moved into and concentrate on their more core activities of really making life easier for students, helping provide the educational resources that they can then be innovative with, and they can then create their own personal learning environments, as they are doing already, by drawing together the various strands that would work for them. So I think we need to recognise the students as being the primary innovators in our institutions and not the staff.
On the issue of a parallel VLE, be very afraid, I found it happening in a primary school. And next one?
Sarah Price, I work for JISC. I've been refining my thinking about labels quite a bit during this conference.
Yeah.
And perhaps even the L in ALT could sometimes stand for labels. And in a way, we need labels because they help us make sense of the world around us. But sometimes they're quite constraining as well. And all the talk of, one label that's come up quite a lot is the debate between digital natives and digital immigrants. You know, I bristle slightly at some of this because I don't think it's the case that older people are unable to cope with a lot of the technology which universities or colleges throw at them. But thinking of providers, which is what this session is looking at, there are quite a few labels that Tim O'Shea invoked yesterday in his talk. You think of Edinburgh, you think Russell Group, think magnificent resources and wealth and all the rest of it. But some of those labels are difficult to argue with, and the thing that he mentioned early on in his talk was the label of the high currency of an Edinburgh degree. Absolutely true, whatever you think. I mean, there were some difficulties, I think, with Tim's talk, if you're not in a Russell Group university or if you're in further education at all. But still, it's difficult to argue with the currency of an Edinburgh degree, and thinking of the provider of the future, somehow if they're not the Russell Group universities, then they're going to have to generate some sort of currency that other people will respect. So it might be Amazon, it might be the Google University of the future, but people are going to have to value that piece of paper with Amazon or Google written on it at the end of their studies.
I absolutely agree. Again, going back to the theme on benchmarking, because of the nature of my role in Microsoft, I spend all of the public sector, and I actually strongly believe that on that issue of labelling, it's very, very interesting to have a conference jointly between medicine and education, because I think the problems in medicine is it's not enough like education, and the problems in education is it's not enough like medicine. So the vagary of terms, even the word sharing, I had real difficulties trying to understand what people thought they meant by sharing. Because it's I share with you, you plagiarise, he steals. I mean, it's an irregular verb that people are using. So that, in medicine, the medical terms are very, very precise, and you can actually have a conversation and everybody knows what you're talking about. But medicine has the same problem, which is we're moving from the treatment of sickness to trying to promote health, in the way we're trying to move from teaching to learning. And the problem is their precision is making it difficult because they like treating sickness. And trying to deal with things like diabetes and stuff like that, where it goes all over the place. So actually it would be very, very interesting to benchmark institutions about how we're moving from sickness to health and how we're moving from teaching to learning. Because that issue of labelling is very, very interesting, because this goes back to this point about play. You need some laxity in terms of the terms. So over-precision has its problems, but under-precision has them. And I think it's a genuine problem.
It's Paul Baxter from Matty Media Limited, and I'm not going to ask for benchmarking directly anyway. It's really about the role of the private sector. I mean, cutting a long story short, seen from outside, and certainly from the kind of US and World Bank venture capitalist fraternity, the US looks incredibly rigid. I mean, teams come here, they can't find anything to buy, and they move on to some kind of more useful country like Poland or the Czech Republic or something. I mean, that's a parody, but, you know, evidence could be given. And viewed, again, from outside, our university, and in fairness to our questioner along there, the college sector looks incredibly rigid. Innovation seemed to rise to a certain level. They stress the university or the system, and then, cruelly, they stop. So it's more like 1,000 trees wilting, perhaps, than 100 trees wilting, than 1,000 flowers wilting now. And that, you know, in the past, the traditional response to government is to reach for the private sector into what some would now call a simplistic view of public-private partnership. Mm. I mean, I'd be interested in your view for the private sector of what more sophisticated models of public-private partnership, and other than higher top-up fees, just getting that in, would unlock the logjam. Because, as I say, perceived from outside, they know we're not doing very well, whatever well means, and that's probably where you can spin it into a benchmark and reply.
Okay. What I think may well happen, actually, if you look at the parallel within my own industry, is to look at EDS. EDS was the in-house IT department of General Motors, and it had the experience of running a global infrastructure and running global IT for a very large corporation dealing with multiple cultures and everything, and did it very successfully. At peak, it was running 40% of all government outsourced IT in the UK. And the reason for that was government IT was very rigid, procurement was very poor, and all sorts of things. Now, these are exactly the parallels. I actually seriously think that there are one or two of the corporate universities which are now getting to a point where they themselves are sufficiently credible to others. In other words, private sector companies go to other private sector companies to do benchmarking and look at them. And I could see one or two of them being floated off, being taken out of their mothership, if you like, and become standalone businesses, and then actually provide services into the sector. And so I think that that may well be the model, rather than let's set up something from scratch going forward. On the other hand, I mean, it is an issue. You know, if somebody like Harvard was to buy the London Business School, I mean, how many other business schools would there be left in the UK? So I think globalisation has some interesting ramifications. So there are consolidation within the sector, particularly around globalisation, or a set of partnerships around specific things that could have very, very... You could reach tipping points very, very quickly. I don't see, except in the Middle East, in particularly the Arab world, and in some of the... But again... there, when I go out there, I find it's all the people who left the UK because it was overly rigid and controlled who are actually out innovating in Bahrain and Dubai and Sharjah and all over the place and Latin America. I mean, the number of people you find who are ex-Open University or ex-British institutions have been doing this stuff for 20, 25 years. And that's quite an important element on it. But I do think that we're going to have to loosen the purse strings and loosen the psychological sense of control within the institutions and within the sector. And I don't know who leads that debate, to be honest, now in the UK.
Jess Martin from Bangor University, and I'm going to mention something about culture. Depending on which side you come from, culture being positive or negative, but I think in this particular instance, I'm talking about a culture being very inhibiting to innovation, and that's the culture of what reward is there in the UK system for being an innovative and good and exciting teacher. When you stack that up against the research culture that we live in, where, you know, the RAE, a five-star A department, it is, I think that the bounty on it now is 40,000 plus per researcher per year that's given in addition. And when I raised this once before, somebody said, well, there is a reward for teaching. You know, the best teacher of the year gets £50,000. Yeah, one prize for the entire UK. And when we look at the reputations of these institutions, you know, the big institutions that we can think of all over the world, we have no idea how good their teaching is. Their reputations are based entirely on the research that they do. So what reward is there in the culture that we presently live in, to push innovation? Intrinsic motivation only goes so far. And then you have the gatekeepers who say, you should be doing research. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, on the JISC online conference earlier this year, I asked whether actually a model where you had research, teaching, and knowledge transfer, the other bit we haven't talked about in this conference, inside the same institution, whether that was viable for the 21st century. I mean, I think that, you know, things like the Steinbeiss Foundation in Baden-Württemberg and these sorts of models where you have separate institutions and people can have multiple hats, but they know which one they're behaving like. I think that there's a fundamental lack of clarity about the role of academics in the way we fund them, reward them, pay them the lot. So they're told, do this but behave like that and you get rewarded on this. So I think we actually engineer some dysfunctional behaviours on the way we do it. And I think, again, so that's why I think some of these issues around the ethical aspects of these things, and that's why expectations of students and what our responsibility to them are, if they're paying and we're rewarding the academics on research. That isn't a viable model, as far as I'm concerned, in the long run, because it won't, you know, you will get dissatisfaction and people leaving. And again, a lot of the academics I work with do a lot of their really interesting work now through the think tanks to avoid the RAE because of some of the stuff they're doing. So if you look at the IPPR and Demos and some of the others, you'll see that going on because they actually have more freedom outside this. And yet people want to protect academic freedom. Well, they don't appear to have it. So let's be honest about it. You know, so.
One at the back, and then I'll come back.
Sally Holden, Peninsula Medical School. As you were talking about the role of academics, I'm a learning technologist and have been for 10 years now, and I do find there's always a sort of friction between the fact that I am a learning technologist, not an academic. And it's quite hard always to bridge that gap and yet not really be taken seriously because I don't have a PhD yet. I don't have time to do it because I'm too busy doing what I'm trying to do and pushing the barriers. And I just think that we talk about academics a lot. Have you got anything to say about the role of learning technologists and people like me?
Well, I mean, on the issue of support, I think that tension is, again, if I am wrong and actually somebody does try to create an entirely new model and go for the radical transformation model in the UK, I suspect it will be about, as I said, like my Amazon model, is that what somebody will do is professionalise support and then give flexibility for the contract for the academic. And actually what you do is recruit all the high-level profile academics who've potentially got brands bigger than the institutions they're in. And that will then starve the big Russell Group brands. And I could see that as a viable model. A lot of organisations in the private sector that have outsourced IT have ended up with far higher satisfaction because they actually have service level agreements and they have expectations which are set and managed. It's not true sometimes in public sector outsourcing, but in private sector outsourcing that's very, very clear because you have to then respect, and actually they end up spending more money on technology after that process because they get, you know, rather than thinking, they start off saying we're going to save money, but they end up spending more because they get a better service. So I do think it's a recognised problem.
Mark Stiles, Staffordshire University. I think one of the things that's worth looking at is the fact that people who work in educational research are constantly frustrated by the lack of impact that educational research actually has on practice. We need to look at that in the context of learning technologies. And I can see some distinct parallels that where you see effective innovation in teaching and learning is very often in the same places you'll see effective innovation in learning technology, which is with the non-traditional cohorts and targets and populations. Yeah. What then seems to happen is in it going from that into the mainstream, we sink back into orthodoxy. So just as mainstream teaching and learning is in many ways anything but constructivist, despite all the rhetoric that we say how wonderful it is, and I agree with it, it is, but when we actually start looking at how people are using their learning environments, what do we actually see? We see a reflection of that same dull orthodoxy in mainstream use of virtual learning environments. Yeah. And I think this is one of the big challenges we've got, and it's one of the problems we have in trying to embed change in the organisations. I'm absolutely convinced that a lot of the problems we have are to do with organisational aspects above everything, you know, because somehow we talk a lot about culture, but when I don't think we can change culture without modifying the organisation. Because the culture exists in that organisational context.
And it's on the purpose. Let me try to illustrate what I think is the challenge in this area. I was at the 12th Global Congress of Obstetrics and Gynaecology in Florence earlier this year. And what's really interesting there is to watch the speed of innovation in medicine because you get a single global conference and all the big pharmaceutical companies are there, the researchers are there, the regulators are there, and the health services and various others are all in the same conference. And they all meet and they have lots of dinner parties and everything, and everybody goes. A few years ago, I did an educational conference, an education research conference in Europe, there were 1,100 educational researchers in the room, and there wasn't a single practicing teacher. And what they were discussing was why they weren't having impact. And, you know, that's why I said, you know, should you be having the users at this conference? Should you have a day where you invite external speakers to talk about how they're doing freedom of information, how they're doing, what it's like to be a user of these services, rather than having this community talk to itself? So I think that but again, that comes back to purpose, and purpose will define the culture. Yeah, so I absolutely agree.
Peter Munday from the Centre for Excellence in Leadership, which is a hell of a title for the organisation. It deals with leadership development in work-based training providers and FE colleges. And you've mentioned several times the sector. And I just wonder which sector we're dealing with, because I would hope ALT would grow and continue to grow and we'd still have the debates that we're having and what's gone on over the past 2 days. But I think there's two things missing, and I just, that's somebody who's been with it for quite a while. One is the emphasis on how we engage, motivate, and retain learners right across the board. And the first time I've heard the word engagement and excitement, words engagement and excitement with today in the last 5 minutes. And really, we should be using technology to do those sorts of things to people. And that's the bit about learning, I think, that was missing. And there's a large part of the sector, work-based training providers, and a significant part of FE, that we're not representing here, need to be brought into this debate too.
Back to those. Yeah, I mean specifically the issue on stakeholder engagements with employers and actually thinking about the kinds of flexibilities that people want in terms of how they balance their work life and learning balance. I mean it's absolutely crucial, and yes. And the trouble is if the debate doesn't happen here, I don't know where else it's going to happen. That's why I said somebody's got to take the lead on that, and I'm reflecting as an outsider. Is that something ALT wants to do and lead on? Yeah. And you know, get serious and move from the playing sort of phase to the being serious on some of these things. So yeah, absolutely, right debate to have.
Hi there, I'm Melanie from Loughborough University. I'm one of those who think that the technology should be the capital letter, because for me, I'm really passionate about technology. And at ALT, it seems to be that there's those who are passionate about teaching who are 3 years behind the technology, and those who are passionate about technology who want to be 3 years ahead. So you've got this huge divide, and it's getting greater, I think.
Yeah.
And for me, ALT is certainly, since I used to come here 4 or 5 years ago, where there was a lot of technologists, now there's a lot of teachers. And when I made the comment that VLEs, for me, VLEs are dead, because I'm going to the place about PLEs, service-oriented stuff, and we should be deciding on the standards, not the applications.
Yeah.
It's a tough one, and it's like being a learning technologist amongst academics. You know, we're minorities, and I have to make a decision now. Do I go into research or technology? If I go into research, I'll be 2 years behind. You know?
Yeah. But the question is, why do you have to make that choice? Because actually we need people who are in both worlds. And so I have a, you know, it seems to me that that's wrong, because what, you know, as I said, a really interesting, you know, what would a Vygotskian learning platform look like? That's a really, really interesting challenge.
I think, right? It's a
management. And, you know, thinking of, you know, which of these technologies would apply and how would you put them together and what would, you know, that would be a really fun challenge to have a go at. Somebody's got to do that.
Mm.
Yeah?
It's a real struggle, because it's the managers who, it's really difficult to explain technology nowadays in layman's terms. 4 years ago, you could do that to managers and they would go with it, but now it's really difficult.
I believe in Douglas Adams' definition. Technology, by definition, is anything that doesn't yet work. As soon as it works, it ceases to be technology and just becomes, and that's when it becomes embedded. And that's why, you know, so that's why I also agree with the earlier remark about not this digital natives, digital immigrants is wrong. It's those people for whom technology works, and that's not about age.
David Nicholls, Strathclyde University. I mean, one question that kind of comes out from, you know, from some of the discussion here is, you know, is what is the purpose of the innovation in the first place, or what's the purpose of the use of the technology, which is kind of getting slightly lost. I mean, you know, the thing you just said about the Vygotsky platform, you know, how would we kind of do this? I mean, one of the most effective innovations in education was maybe Mazur's peer instruction from the US, where, you know, the innovation, you know, used the technology, but it was really an educational idea that drove it, and it was very successful. It spread right across the world. You know, what can we learn from this? I mean, there's something about the educational idea behind the innovation as being important, because if you look at all the innovations in technology in the UK, is there any evidence that they're improving the quality of teaching and learning?
The interesting thing is, 10 years ago, I asked the Department for Education to show me the evidence that actually increasing expenditure on books improved education, and also that improving the quality of teaching improved the quality of learning. And actually, there's a pause. Forget the technology. You can't. It's actually very difficult to do that. And we're expected and trying to do things we can't do in the old world. For a lot of the reasons that Tim O'Shea mentioned yesterday, there isn't a single dominant theory of learning. And therefore, I think the real challenge we've got is trying, you know, we measure what we measure. But, you know, I mean, you can go through, and I've sort of done sort of and seen various analyses. You know, we've got more British Nobel Prize winners with thirds than firsts. So there's a really interesting thing in terms of what we traditionally measure and whether it's actually valuable. And you can see that these sort of issues about, you know, the people who dropped out of school actually earn more money, you know, the entrepreneurs who drop out, than the entrepreneurs who went through university. You can see these sort of things going on. So we're looking for value added on top of what to me looks like quicksand. And that's why we've got to have that real debate on that. No, so absolutely.
But I mean, one of the issues, and coming back to purpose and motivation, is that that there isn't actually a focus on what we're actually trying to achieve. I mean, if you look at the Carol Twigg work in the US, I mean, basically, you know, she went out to prove that you could create cost savings in higher education and by redesigning courses and improve quality based on the kinds of learning outcome measures that she used. And she, I mean, there's questions about how she actually got her studies, and I think it's interesting, but she proved it. You know, she did prove that you could actually achieve that if you were incredibly one-pointed about what you did, and you actually had the support to do it, and using technology. So are there any lessons to learn from that?
The issue fundamentally comes down, I think, to an ethical issue about access and availability of learning. So whether it's the UN Millennium Goals for education, the question is, how do we create a scalable, flexible infrastructure to allow 7 billion people on this planet to have access to their learning needs? Now, technology, I genuinely don't believe you can't do that without technology. I just don't think it's feasible to consider any other model that would enable us to do that. How we in the developed world actually contribute towards that and think about lowering the barriers for people with disabilities, for people with learning difficulties and all these sort of things. And those come from a fundamental sense of purpose. So the whole educational issue. Now, there are points like Tim O'Shea's example of being able to sit next to somebody and opposite them at the same time, where you genuinely do have a very, very good reason for thinking, from a learning perspective, what is the capacity to be able to do something that has no physical counterpart? But actually, there aren't that many of those, to be honest. Most of it does have, and that's why it would be interesting. As I said, it might be to have three streams at this conference, one which is the little L, big T, one is the big L, little T, and one is the big L, big T model, and actually think about what those streams would look like. But I actually think you should. Next year, I would really think it would be really interesting to have that debate about, you know, what is the educational value we're trying to create from this? Because I think this community probably knows the answer, but I'm not sure it's articulated it to itself and therefore can't influence others to believe that.
Nils Jones from the British Council. It's very fortunate that we in the UK have a preeminence in this area of learning technology. Many other countries look to us as a leader in innovation in education and in embedding learning technologies to achieve educational purposes. But it's a very fast-moving terrain out there, and there are many other countries and regions where the pace of development is faster than our own.
Yeah.
And one of the things that ALT can do for us that I think is really important is in building up those international networks to other professional associations in other countries, in maintaining our knowledge of what is happening for our use in the UK, so that we're not only exporting our best practice but learning from others' best practice, but building up those international liaisons, those international research groups that can then help us to take our own area of business forward. So I would very much welcome ALT's strengthening of its international partnerships and the role that each one of us here can play in making that into a living, breathing, very, very positive experience for the UK participants.
Amen.
Hi, Drew Whitworth again from Manchester. I mean, something that I found out through my studies in this area is that basically you have to look at the fact that technologies and organisations from a certain point of view are the same thing. And, you know, they're designed often for specific purposes, but more often than not informally through a series of accidents. They fit in particular environments. They work more or less well. They sometimes can be schizoid. They, you know, and they sometimes work well together. And on the one hand, that leads to two contradictions. The first one is that we are trying to be both scientists and social scientists at the same time. You know, they've got the technologists on the one hand looking at things, as you said, trying to use precise language, trying to be sure about what it is that they're talking about and using particular methodologies. And then the application of that technology suddenly hits the messiness and, you know, divergent endpoints of social science and organized human activity. And that's difficult. That's difficult for any discipline to try to deal with those two things simultaneously. And on the other hand, you have this contradiction in that, on the one hand, we are being asked to produce and indeed to be ourselves critically self-reflective students and learners and teachers. I believe that's the way forward for society, personally. I certainly think it's also the way forward for our dealings with technology. It's not a matter of learning to use a technology, learning to use WebCT. Why are we still doing that? We should be teaching people to get this flexible, critical attitude to life generally, amongst which is their use of technology. And that goes for in the workplace as well as for the students that we're trying to produce. But on the other hand, you have these big economic pressures towards consolidation within a market, towards a large institutional solution, and to look towards the blackboard, WebCT, and if I may, sort of Microsoft, large institutions, large global solutions, standards, protocols, and all these other things that on a technological level are very helpful. But when you lock together the technology and the organization in these two ways, you know, we will not be able to transform one without transforming the other. And they both pull each other back. They're in a symbiotic relationship. And sometimes symbiotic relationships can be very healthy for both parties, but sometimes they can prevent either party getting anywhere because they start to depend on each other. And, you know, I work for a university with aspirations to be one of the best, as I'm sure many people do here. And I hope they do. I like working. I like having the support and, to a certain extent, the safety net of working for an institution like that, and it is a brand, but at the same time, it's never going to change. I mean, we think that e-learning is disruptive, and we maybe underestimate the sheer preservative power that these very large institutions have, simply because there are so many people with so much to lose.
The dinosaurs died out, and they were very successful, one of the most successful species on this planet. And the question is, I think it's not a question that the Russell Group will all survive and the others will vanish. I think there are going to be significant institutional failures at all levels. And I think that's probably going to be the shock that comes in. I do think, again, going back to the issues on governance, I mean, it's worth looking at the kinds of models of organisations like Microsoft. I mean, we only employ 60,000 staff worldwide. We have 784,000 partner organisations. So for every person we employ direct, you know, any project that we run, we're about 5% of the budget. I mean, that's the model, and that means we can scale up and down because we have many organisations we work with that have more Microsoft skills than we do. And I was telling somebody, we don't even train Microsoft staff on the use of Microsoft products with Microsoft people because we're not experts in training, so we've outsourced that. I mean, why should we? Why don't we give it to somebody else to do? And so this sort of model of the consolidated body that does everything and employs everybody directly, you can't do that in global reach. And when you know, and you look at Cisco and you look at all these other sort of organisations, the biggest companies in the world are increasingly getting smaller in terms of the number of people they employ directly. And this move towards ecosystems in the management buzzword of the decade is the way in which people are doing it. So I suspect that the big branded universities will probably have fewer people rather than, you know, a university has to have a million students to be viable. So I think that the trouble is we've got old thinking on consolidation rather than new thinking on consolidation. Yeah, but it's interesting that that debate goes on in the coffee breaks and in the lunch tables, but it's not part of the formal conference. And I mean, it's quite that's you know part of my observation that I made on here, and I think that you know that's what I'd ask you to reflect on.
Mark Stiles, one of the things that has also struck me about the, if you like, the nature of innovation and education. Right. Is that we very much like to consume our own product. We tend to be somewhat ghettoised. We even like our innovations to be ones that we've thought of or ones that excite us as educators. Yes. One of the things that struck me profoundly recently was we hear a lot of talk about the need to do building of communities of practice, community work, et cetera, online. And we see all the stuff going on with blogs and wikis, etc. So I actually had started looking at what people in the real world did in terms of communities on the web. And the vast majority of active web communities are based on forum software. And yet the use of forum software in learning technology circles and in education is tiny. Yeah. And yet, I mean, I've seen viable communities funded by of such scale, they're funded by advertising. They can attract advertising with forums that have taken a million posts. Those are real live communities, and yet we have just more or less ignored that technology because it's not exciting. And yet it must be clearly effective. So there's an issue there about us engaging with real life to some extent, I think.
Yeah. I'm not going to respond to that. I think you've hit my central thesis about where you are on the maturity curve now and what you need to step forward. So, okay, Terry, do you want to? Sorry?
It's Wilma Alexander, University of Edinburgh. There seem to me to be three very significant absences from almost any alt conference that I've been at. One is a significant presence of librarians. They've just been allowed in because they've rebranded themselves as digital curators. But librarians know a lot about two things that we can learn from in ALT. One is the professionalisation of a group of people. It's a process they went through about 30 years ago. And it was a painful process for many of the people in that profession. The other is managing stuff, looking after stuff, and providing it to people as a service. Librarians see themselves as service providers, first and foremost, regardless of whether they're handling ancient manuscripts or some kind of digital material. So I think they need to be allowed in. Another absence is people who understand human-computer interaction and usability professionals who take a very clear and scientific approach to many of the issues that we're nibbling around the edges of and have been for many years. A third major absence, which I have heard mentioned a couple of times, is people who are at the cutting edge of management and understanding organisational structures. And I think as a group, as a conference, we need to think very hard about bringing those kinds of people in and for their knowledge, for what they already understand that we don't yet understand about what we're trying to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's within Microsoft Research, I mean, we have people like ethnographers now, you know, for that very reason, because, you know, where we're trying to look, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, I think that that's very important. Again, going back to one of the earlier points that was made, which I suddenly point clicked on this, about future technologies. I mean, we had a couple of discussions around search technologies, and a lot of the conversations were around about what search can do today, not around next generation search. And if I said, invite you, go and have a look at the Microsoft Research website on next generation search and search of images and by mathematical inspection and stuff. That has huge ramifications for those of you who believe in meta tagging. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff out there. So I do think there is, again, the futures bit in there is something that if you want that community to be vibrant within here, that you need to be able to look at what's going to come next rather than what's hot now.
Our first pause. My sense is that people would probably welcome us moving towards rounding this session off and having a comfort break before the final plenary. Was any last burning contribution? Chris, would you like to attempt a soundbite summary of the?
Well, I just say just one observation as an outsider on this is that the language within which this conference is conducted is more penetrable than many other communities. And I think it does reflect that it's not just a bunch of tech heads and people who play with technology. There's a diversity, and therefore you can't lapse into a jargon that's completely impenetrable to an outsider. And that is something that I think is important, and it's one of the reasons I've enjoyed this experience, because I haven't had to go and ask some of my friends what the hell that was about. Only once. So that's a sign of success, and I think you need to keep that alive, because once you do get into a sort of secret language that nobody else understands, I mean, you will be lost. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we ought to thank Chris. I mean, I was confident that Chris would sustain a high-level debate. I think we've had it, actually, and it is a tribute to what he brings to this conference. So I wonder if we could just thank Chris, and indeed thank yourselves for what's been an excellent session. Thank you.